This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll get an update on the long-standing case of Leonard Peltier, unjustly incarcerated for the killing of two FBI special agents at a shootout on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Former federal prosecutor Cynthia Dunn joins us to discuss an initiative aimed at getting clemency for Peltier. We'll speak with author Allison Flowers on her new book, Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. This book feels especially timely now, given the increasing number of exonerations in the United States. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. A few hours before we recorded today's show, one of New York City's most powerful and influential leaders was arrested by the FBI in his Bronx home at 6 a.m. on federal fraud charges. The charges offer a glimpse into the character of a man who has single-handedly stood in the way for years of making inroads into criminal justice reform for persons held at Rikers Island. While this is a local development in New York City, it serves as an example of how one corrupt man can thwart reform efforts and ruin the lives of countless individuals and communities. Norman Seabrook, a close friend of Mayor de Blasio, is president of the Correction Officers Benevolent Association, which has 9,000 members. The federal charges arise from the first major criminal case linked to one of several corruption investigations focused on de Blasio's campaign fundraising. Also arrested was hedge fund financier Murray Huberfeld, founder of Centurion Credit Management, later subsumed by top-performing Platinum Partners. These charges involve Seabrook's investment of approximately $10 million from his union's pension fund in Platinum Partners through Huberfeld, and Mr. Huberfeld's payment of a kickback to the union leader. Seabrook, who according to the New York Times favors, quote, finely tailored suits and cigars and is chauffeured around the city in black SUVs, is no stranger to lawsuits ranging from corruption to sexual harassment. And over the years, he has withstood them all. I cannot overstate how detrimental Seabrook has been in his official role as president of the Corrections Officers Union. I've selected a few points raised in an excellent 2014 New York Times article called At Rikers Island, Union Chief's Clout is a Roadblock to Reform. These demonstrate what Seabrook has done, in part, to stand in the way of much-needed reforms. We mentioned this earlier on Law and Disorder, but it's worth noting that in 2012, when Florence Finkel, then chief investigator for the New York City Correction Department, addressed senior officers and union leaders with plans to crack down on abuse and send more cases to prosecutors, Seabrook launched a two-year campaign to get rid of her. He called for her resignation, interfered with some of her investigations, and had one of her top staffers transferred, while also denouncing Finkel on his weekly radio show. He ultimately succeeded in forcing her out and replaced her with one of his childhood friends, a former senior police official. Seabrook has exercised unparalleled control over the correction department, consulting with commissioners on key appointments, building alliances with high-ranking uniform correction leaders, and speaking often with Mayor de Blasio about departmental policy. A New York Times investigation cites his influence as reaping enormous dividends for his members and feeding a culture of violence and corruption at Rikers. Current and former city officials have repeatedly described Seabrook as the biggest obstacle to efforts to curb brutality and malfeasance at Rikers. He has vigorously resisted stiffer penalties for use of excessive force by guards and has fought stronger screening measures designed to stop corrections officers from smuggling contraband into the jails. Time and time again, Seabrook has shielded members from serious punishments when investigators like Florence Finkel tried to go after them. Seabrook is known as a bully. His influence within the department comes in part from a fear of what he might do to his critics. When the Times interviewed a dozen current and former senior city officials, both inside and outside the department, who worked with him closely over the years. They were privately critical, but afraid to openly discuss Seabrook, citing concerns that he would derail their careers. Some also expressed fears about their personal safety when visiting Rikers, worrying that a correction officer might look the other way if an inmate became violent. On November 18, 2013, when Rikers inmate Dupre Peterson was to testify against two corrections officers in a brutality case, Seabrook shut down the city's courts by sidelining the buses that ferry inmates to and from court. Hundreds of inmates missed their court dates, including Peterson, whose beating had been investigated and referred for prosecution, again, by Florence Finkel. Seabrook is puerile and unfit for his job. In November 2012, then-Commissioner Donna Shiro was leading several dozen women into Rikers Island for a tour. Seabrook dispatched one of his officers dressed as the children's cartoon character, Dora the Explorer, to, get this, dance on the side of the road, stalling the commissioner's bus as drivers stopped to gawk and backing up traffic for miles. The delay was costly and required the city to pay overtime when officers could not get onto the island for a shift change. Seabrook engages in ad hominem attacks on reformists. When de Blasio appointed Joseph Ponte as the new correction commissioner, inmate advocates were hopeful because Ponte had worked in jails and prisons for more than 45 years and had an excellent reputation for reform. But even before he arrived, Seabrook called a news conference to attack him, calling his approach, quote, "hug a thug." Despite recent media attention on Rikers, violence by correction officers and inmates has continued to rise. There were 88 stabbings and slashings by inmates and over 750 assaults on uniformed staff members in the 2014 fiscal year, compared with just 34 and 500 respectively 4 years earlier. And in the first 10 months of 2015, officers used physical force against inmates nearly 3,500 times, about 1,000 more than the year before. Nevertheless, Mayor de Blasio continues to embrace Seabrook. Seabrook's arrest last week on federal fraud charges offers the first glimmer of hope that the most significant obstacle to reform at Rikers Island may be soon approaching an end. Seabrook should be removed from office immediately, and Commissioner Joseph Ponte allowed to do his job. Leonard Peltier is a Native American activist convicted of killing two FBI special agents, Jack Kohler and Ronald Williams, during a shootout on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. He has spent more than four decades in prison, despite the fact that prosecutors and federal agents manufactured evidence against him, suppressed evidence that would establish his innocence, presented false testimony obtained through harsh interrogation, defied court orders, and perjured themselves to the jury. Numerous constitutional violations plagued Peltier's case, and many dignitaries, governments, and international human rights organizations continue to call for his release. The Bush administration denied clemency to Peltier, and efforts are underway to urge President Obama to grant executive clemency before he leaves office. Here to join us is former federal prosecutor Cynthia Dunn, who now directs a nonprofit that works with youth on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Cindy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you, Heidi. Thank you for inviting me to your show today.
For nearly three decades, you were assistant U.S. attorney and senior trial counsel in the office of the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. How did you get involved in Leonard Peltier's case?
Well, that's an interesting story. I'm kind of an unlikely ally, and I understand why you're asking that. But in the 28 years or so that I was an assistant U.S. attorney, I handled a number of civil rights cases involving either abuse of authority and other civil rights matters. And I also handled a number of public corruption cases during my time there, and so I really know the area of law that is involved in the Peltier case. And when I took a leave of absence in 2012 from the office, I started volunteering with a group that works on Pine Ridge Reservation. It's a nonprofit, and Pine Ridge Reservation is in South Dakota. And the name Leonard Peltier just kept coming up. And at one point, one of my friends, in fact, said to me, do yourself a favor and never state your opinion on it, because he assumed, as I did, that I would oppose Leonard's release. The name had come up during the years at the office, but it was just in the context of someone who had murdered two FBI agents, and I had really never looked beyond it. But ultimately, working more and more in the community, the name kept coming up more and more, so I decided, well, let me take an independent look at this, you know, with obviously the benefit of hindsight and also knowledge in the area of law that is really sparked by his case. And when I did, I surprised myself and concluded that really, you know, it's too bad that nothing had been done before, but now is really, it really should be done. And I believe that President Obama, who has done so much to start the process of healing with Native nations, is really the right president for this. And I thought, in my assessment, that we stood a credible shot at getting him clemency at this time, and that the nation should support this.
We'll get to the matter of clemency in a few minutes. And we've covered Leonard's case on Law and Disorder in the past, but for listeners who may not be familiar with the facts, can you briefly summarize the case and what you think are the most troubling aspects?
Right. Well, the case involves a shootout that occurred on the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1975. But to understand what actually happened in that event, you have to understand the surrounding circumstances that were facing Native American communities across the nation, and the, I guess, the prevailing worldview of non-Natives during that time period. Historically, we have the problem that Americans are not taught American history that includes Native American history. We're taught the Declaration of Independence, but we're not taught that the document refers to American Indians as savages. So, I mean, we aren't taught from the beginning, you know, how the American Indians were teed up through our historical process. It's just not in the American curriculum. So you start with that, and then you end up in 1973 with the Wounded Knee siege by the American Indian Movement, where American Indians were starting to get organized and to try to assert their rights, and were involved in an incident on the Pine Ridge Reservation where they were trying to bring attention to their corrupt tribal government, to the breach of treaties with American Indian tribes, etc. And the FBI intervened in that incident in what I'm going to term a Waco-like intervention. It was totally
not their jurisdiction.
They had jurisdiction for major crimes during that time period, but they didn't manage it properly. The result after their intervention was that Pine Ridge Reservation became the murder capital of the nation, and perhaps the world. Crime soared. The polarized community on Pine Ridge became more dangerous, and it was really a war zone pretty much at all times, and people were being killed, and murder prosecutions were not being launched by the FBI. There was a lot of discontent, and it really hurt relations with Native American tribal communities and law enforcement, this 1973 uprising. So this was in the wake of this. 1975, people were being murdered, and the American Indian Movement was asked to come to their assistance to help protect some of the people, the traditionalists who were being assaulted and murdered by the members of the tribal police and the tribal government, and Leonard Peltier was one of a handful of young men who went out there to help protect people from, you know, the drive-by shootings, etc. And he only arrived on Pine Ridge a few days before, a few weeks, maybe 2 or 3 weeks before the incident occurred, but he was guarding the Jumping Bull property. The family was the Jumping Bull family, and they owned property in the town of Oglala on Pine Ridge Reservation. And two FBI agents were dispatched one day to make an arrest, and they went on their own to they were going to arrest a young man for stealing a pair of cowboy boots, allegedly. And they went to the Jumping Bull property, and they went without any kind of backup, without any kind of identification or broadcast information to say who they were coming into this private property, which had been under siege for months at that point and had been prone to assaults. They entered there, and a shootout occurred that involved many, many people, but only a handful of them were ultimately charged for the deaths of the two FBI agents that occurred in that shootout. Two FBI agents died, as did one American Indian. As far as we can determine, I have not done an exhaustive search, but certainly it has been reported that there was no real investigation done of the death of the American Indian. But what occurred next was really somewhat of a remarkable and unprecedented investigation on the Pine Ridge Reservation to find and hold somebody accountable for the deaths of the FBI agents. And as an aside, I'm just going to add that today, and maybe, I don't know what caused the change, but I know that under today's procedure and during the almost 30 years that I worked in federal law enforcement, there is a procedure now for arrest. You would never dispatch two young men to Washington Heights, much less the Pine Ridge Reservation, to make an arrest without proper backup. Now there are arrest plans, there's aerials done, there's all sorts of things done to protect and prevent any kind of injury to anybody in the course of an arrest. But back in the 1970s, it just wasn't the procedure or practice.
So essentially, those two agents were going into a scenario that was perilous with no backup.
Right. It was reckless under today's standards, definitely. It doesn't, you know, excuse the outcome on either side, the death of the agents nor the American Indian, young American Indian man who died, but it does explain in part why it happened. This was a invitation for disaster, and disaster happened, yeah. Following the incident, Leonard Peltier fled. Everybody sort of scattered after literally hours of shooting because the agents had called in backup who were down in Pine Ridge and things that, you know, so the place was swarmed with people shooting on both sides for hours. And after that, the FBI really launched an unprecedented assault on the entire Oglala Lakota Nation. They brought in hundreds of FBI agents, swarmed the property with helicopters and all sorts of equipment. And at the time, the tribal government asked for intervention by the other people in the federal government because they felt that their community was just being overrun. And the U.S. Civil Rights Commission dispatched an observer. And his report is just really, it's chilling. There's really no other word to call it because he was contemporaneously recording what he saw. He didn't, you know, he was objective observer and, you know, he saw warrantless searches, detentions without cause. He described one incident where a lawyer who was attempting to get to a court to prevent a warrantless search was actually restrained, physically restrained, to prevent him from taking any kind of action. He saw aggressive conduct towards the reservation's residents, and he reported to his, and he also reported false that the FBI agents were making false reports to the press to try to pitch the event as different than it had actually occurred. And he reported to his superiors the complaints of overreaching were sufficiently credible to cast doubt on the propriety of the actions of the FBI and also raised questions about their impartiality and the focus of their concern. He, on multiple occasions, asked for intervention and supervision, and as did his superiors, and the Justice Department and other groups ignored his requests. So their conduct went on without being supervised or watched at all by people, objective observers other than the Civil Rights Commission.
Mm-hmm. And this is during the investigation?
Yes, this was during the investigation, before any arrests were made.
When Peltier was arrested, did he soon get legal representation? I understand that he had one attorney that had no experience in homicide cases.
When Peltier was arrested, he was in Canada. He was extradited from Canada, and that is its own remarkable situation. He was arrested in Canada based on, in part, on three affidavits or a series of affidavits that the FBI agents, I mean, I'm going to say they fabricated the affidavits. They were signed by an actual person who later recanted them, but they're inherently and internally inconsistent and incredible. And when you put them side by side, you just can't believe that, you know, two federal agents who were sworn to uphold the Constitution could have put these documents together, but they did. Two of the three affidavits were ultimately submitted to the Canadian courts, and they purported to be affidavits of an eyewitness who observed Leonard Peltier shooting one of the agents and also attested to statements he made about the shootings, allegedly. But they have, over the years, those affidavits have been discredited not only by the courts, but they've also FBI has completely revoked any kind of support for their accuracy.
Mm.
So they have acknowledged that they were inaccurate, but, you know, have an explanation.
Well, I read that a now retired prosecutor, Len Crox, has publicly gone on record saying that the FBI actually does not know who shot the agents. In light of the many issues related to prosecutorial misconduct and improprieties, in terms of the procedural aspects of Leonard's case, has he exhausted all appeals?
He has exhausted all appeals. And, you know, I'm coming in much later, so I have the benefit of hindsight. But, you know, part of what has discredited the conviction over the decades is that he has repeatedly and continually fought to get access to records that the government had and never produced to him. There were, among those records, were exculpatory records. There were ballistics records that contradicted the government's proof at trial. There were records that showed that he was at the time on the FBI's watch list as a potential extremist because he was a member of the American Indian Movement. Records that, you know, they didn't have the benefit of at the time of trial. And slowly, each time he's found one of these things, he's brought it to the court and sought some sort of action. But if he'd had them all to begin with, it would have been, one, a different trial, completely different trial, and two, each time the court has considered his motions, it's just been on one little piece of evidence. When you put them all together, it's really pretty amazing, really indictment of our system, because it's you just can't believe that so many things, so many ethical lines were breached, so many documents were withheld, and still today, Leonard Peltier does not have access to all of the records about his case and his investigation. And those records that he does have, which I've reviewed, are so heavily redacted on the grounds of, quote, national security, which, even giving the government the benefit of the doubt, if that were the case in 1975, could not possibly be the case today when he's trying to get those records.
I recall we did an interview on this case a few years ago, and at the time, the issue was a Freedom of Information Act request trying to get, I think it was 90,000 pages, that, as you said, the government was objecting to release in the name of interfering with the nation's war on transnational terrorism.
Right.
I would suppose the FBI might be embarrassed to have this information come to the light of day.
You know, it's kind of hard to guess what is in there. Sometimes you can guess what's in there by the context, but sometimes entire pages are redacted, so which, you know, to non-lawyers means that they're just blacked out.
Right.
So there's no way of really knowing what was there, you can imagine, but, you know, you don't know. But I can't imagine, based on my experience in law enforcement, what kind of content in this context could have been redacted appropriately.
Right. Got it.
Yeah.
Now, Cindy, let's talk for a minute about Leonard. I know is it 71 years old now?
Yes, he's 71 years old.
How is his health?
His health is very poor. I mean, just as an aside, I mean, I met him in October 2015. I went down and saw him at Coleman Maximum Security Prison, where he's incarcerated right now.
And where is that?
It's in Coleman, Florida. It's right outside of Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
He is in very poor health, and since that time, he has been diagnosed with a abdominal aortic aneurysm, which is on the edge of being subject to rupture.
Right.
If it were to rupture, he's in a facility that does not have the medical capacity
He'll
to
die.
Save his life.
Yeah.
He has outlived actuarial predictions for life in federal prison, and he is one of the oldest prisoners at that facility. He is not able to defend himself if he is under attack or violence erupts in the facility. He's just too old for that. It's not a old man's game, so to speak. Often he's placed into solitary for his own protection, sometimes for security reasons, health reasons, etc. He's 71 years old. He spent over 40 years in jail. He has spent over 5 of those years in solitary confinement, which to me, again, is just a remarkable amount of time to spend in solitary confinement. I understand
it's torture.
It's torture, and I understand that there are certain situations where a person might have to be kept in those conditions if they are a serial murderer. Every time they get to a phone, they order something violent to be done. But this is not Leonard Peltier. This is a man who was an activist and misunderstood in the 1970s when he asked for the government to honor its treaties and was labeled and branded an extremist because of that. And, you know, this is not a man who is a mass murderer. This is a man who is, you know, held firm to his Lakota heritage and has continued to do good works from prison. He's become quite an accomplished artist during that time period. He's very involved in humanitarian efforts and supporting humanitarian things and cultural events on various reservations to help preserve the language and culture for the various tribal communities. You know, it's again another remarkable situation that, you know, I really hope that he needs to get out. He needs to get out. He needs to be able to live his final years on the reservation and to meet his great-grandchildren and get to know his grandchildren. And enough is enough. It's
right.
Been 40 years on a wrongful conviction, and enough is enough.
Cindy, we just have a few minutes left. Let's talk about the petition for executive clemency. I know that people are sending letters. And Martin Garbus is now working on the case. We know Martin. He's been on the show. And that's how you got involved, correct?
Yeah. He reached out to me. I had, at some point in 2015, I wrote a opinion piece about Leonard's case, which was picked up by Indian Country Today, which is sort of the New York Times of Indian Country.
Right.
And they published it, and it got a whole lot of play. And a few weeks later, maybe a week later, I got a call from Martin asking me to meet with him in New York, which we did, and we discussed Leonard's case and the clemency petition that he was in the process of putting together, and we discussed strategy. We agreed. You know, he's really a remarkable attorney and advocate and has a great understanding of the community because it's where he really started out as a young trial lawyer.
Oh.
Yeah, he had handled some of the Wounded Knee 1973 prosecutions. Yeah.
Right. And so the petition has been filed?
Yes, it was filed in February of this year with the Justice Department. The process is that it goes to the Justice Department's pardon attorney, and then from there it either does or does not go to President Obama for his consideration. We are certainly hoping that it will go to President Obama. We have requested a meeting with the pardon attorney, which is our right to request. We have not heard from them. We have followed up several times and have not heard from them. We really hope that it will go to President Obama because, like I said, he appears to have a very good understanding of Native American communities and the injustices that they have faced over the centuries.
Pardoning Peltier would certainly be an important part of Obama's legacy. If listeners want to get involved, is there a website? What can they do?
Yeah, the Leonard Peltier International Defense Committee maintains a website, and it has links to a petition, and certainly I think that, you know, they can write a letter to President Obama urging him to consider clemency, and I really wish they would. If they could write to their congressional representatives and senators, that also could be helpful just to show public support. The last time that Leonard applied for clemency, the majority of the FBI agents across the nation took a day off and picketed the White House. So, regardless of the fact that even, I mean, most of the people who are working for the FBI right now are younger than 40 years old and probably weren't even alive during this time period of discrimination and injustices towards the Oglala Lakota Nation where this occurred. But, you know, we anticipate that they will again organize and just, you know, to oppose. And certainly we've been given that indication by the FBI Agents Association, which has been very vocal in its opposition to our action.
Well, that's all the more reason for us to really bring together a wide people's movement to change public opinion.
It really is. You know, last time around, Congressman Don Edwards, who was a congressman for California, he was a former special agent, and he was very vocal in his condemnation of the FBI's conduct during that time, because he actually took the time to look beyond the rhetoric and the party line to actually look at the case with the benefit of hindsight and say, this is something that needs to be corrected, and this is something that needs to be corrected for, most importantly, Leonard Peltier, but also for our nation. And President Obama, we hope, will stand on the side of history that acknowledges the wrongdoing and makes a statement to the world that America and its government will not turn a blind eye or ignore injustices and unfair treatment to Native Americans.
Cynthia Dunn, Leonard Peltier is indeed fortunate to have you and Martin Garbus on his side. We really appreciate this thorough overview of the case. It's been very insightful, and we're rooting for Leonard to get out.
Thank you, Heidi. It really means a lot. And thank you so much. And thank you for having me on the show.
We'll talk again.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. More and more, it seems we hear stories of wrongfully convicted persons being released after years, even decades, behind bars in the United States. Helping to secure their freedom are innocence projects across the nation, dedicated attorneys, and years of painstaking work to uncover prosecutorial misconduct, false eyewitness identifications, or forensic mishaps. What we don't hear about, however, is how exonerated individuals piece their lives back together after these lengthy periods of incarceration. Award-winning journalist Allison Flowers has humanized four such persons in her new book, Exonery Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. Allison is a Social Justice News Nexus Fellow and works at the Invisible Institute in Chicago. Allison, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We seem to be seeing an uptick in exonerations around the country, and there's even a national registry to keep track of them. How often do exonerations occur?
We're seeing exonerations in the United States every 3 days, and that could be for two reasons, I suppose. One is that wrongful convictions are happening more frequently, or we're getting better at overturning wrongful convictions and setting the innocent free. So there is the National Registry of Exonerations, which has been around for a couple of years. It's the official tracker of exonerations, and it tracks them since 1989, and we have more than 1,800 exonerations. But of course, that's not every case that's been overturned. There's no way to really know for sure when that has happened other than hearing about it in the media or from a lawyer or from a tip. The courts are not so uniform that there is a way to just look up cases that have been overturned on evidence of innocence. And so the National Registry keeps track of this the best it can, and it has for several years. And as a result, it allows us to see what the contributing factors are to wrongful convictions, to study them, to track them. And so we know now that an exoneration happens about every 3 days for a variety of reasons.
How did you come to write this book?
I was a research associate at Northwestern University, and I was working for the Medill Justice Project, which was a founding member of the Innocence Network. And at the time when I was working there, I was investigating potentially wrongful murder convictions. And so I was sort of on the front end of doing innocence work, if you will, as a journalist. I was working with students, going back, looking at old cases. And that's incredibly powerful work, and we need more of it, of course. It did occur to me one day while I was preparing to go into my, you know, basement academic office, what happens when the innocent are set free? Of course, we were doing all this work to help free the innocent, but I wondered what was in place when those people were set free. At the time, there wasn't much attention being paid to that issue. Now we're even seeing the editorial board at the New York Times weighing in on this, a very important issue, because there are serious gaps when it comes to caring for the wrongly convicted when they are, you know, in rare circumstances, able to leave prison. When you leave prison, of course, you don't get any compensation right away, or perhaps not at all ever. So not a dime is in your pocket. You're really left empty-handed without even so much as a bus pass. And if you're in the position to be wearing clothing or shoes or anything that belongs to the prison, you actually might get a bill later. So it's such a slap in the face after being so deeply wronged by the system. And on top of that, you know, your family has moved on, your children don't know you anymore, your spouse probably divorced you a long time ago, and your record isn't automatically expunged. And to go through the process of trying to get it expunged, to clear your name, and to get any measure of compensation, which would depend on which state you live in, since 20 states still don't have any policies for that, it can be an extremely difficult journey, beginning at a moment that is kind of perceived in the media, which I think is a myth, as being victorious, you know, being released from prison and, you know, being declared innocent. It's really not that way at all.
And there are, I believe, as you've noted, misperceptions that exonerees come into a lot of money, fed by the media. You do such a wonderful job in the vignettes in your book of detailing really the mundane aspects of what it's like to walk out with a few dollars in your pocket and then for those who have family ties that still exist to really pull together those tenuous threads and fashion a life after being inside for so long. What other misperceptions did you try to address in your book?
Well, I think you noted the primary ones, which are that, you know, you're suddenly a multimillionaire. Those are definitely very rare cases when an exoneree is able to earn a civil judgment or a settlement and receive a lot of money like that. Very few cases are well suited for that. Proving prosecutorial misconduct is so difficult, and you really, you know, pretty much have to be like beat by police in order for that to have been to happen to you, in order to be able to win that much money. So that is a huge misconception. Of course, you know, exonerees are hit up for money all the time by old contacts coming forward. Can I have a little money here and there, or from family? There's just this perception that they're rolling in it, and they're just really not. And of course, finding a job is extremely difficult. You know, one exoneree in the book filled out hundreds and hundreds of job applications before he was able to finally find work. And in one case, you know, they didn't really look at his resume because he put his wrongful conviction up top to be very upfront about it, which is recommended. And yet he went in for his interview and they said to him, sorry, we don't hire convicted murderers, because he didn't clear their background check once he had already driven out, you know, very much out of his way for that interview, which was very crushing to him. You know, he, at the time he was sleeping in his granddaughters had given up their bed for him to sleep on. So I think there's just this misconception that, that you're fine, that, you know, prison being released was this victorious Hollywood ending, when really it's just the beginning of the story.
In your book, I noticed there seems to be a focus on Chicago exonerations. Can you explain that?
Yes. So Chicago is in Cook County, which is the wrongful conviction capital of the country. It has the highest number of exonerations, and trailing behind is Harris County in Texas, which may surpass Chicago or Cook County very soon. You know, Chicago has a very deep-rooted history of racism and violence within the police department and within the city. And that is something that is slowly coming to light more and more, as we saw recently with the Laquan McDonald shooting video and all the fallout from that and the upheaval in the city. You know, there's a deeper history than that, which goes to a former police commander named John Burge, who is nationally notorious as well. And under Burge and his crew of officers, he systematically tortured more than 100 African-American and Hispanic men, many into confessions and wrongful convictions. So he is a thread throughout the book. Of course, the danger is thinking that the Burge torture era is a thing of the past. This sort of thing still does happen in Chicago, and wrongful convictions are still happening. You know, we mentioned the exoneration registry earlier, and again, a benefit of that registry is that we can study the cases that we do know about and see what the contributing factors were to that wrongful conviction. And official misconduct in some form accounts for more than half of exonerations. And so when you consider that here in Chicago, where we now know that 97% of police misconduct goes undisciplined, I think there's a very strong link between the misconduct that citizens face at the hands of police and the fact that people are wrongfully convicted many times as a result. Of course, that would be very difficult to study, but you know, we hear in so many complaints of citizens of false arrests and having things planted on them. And so a wrongful conviction doesn't happen in the courtroom. It actually starts early with the first interaction with police.
Mm, so true. And we've had many people from the People's Law Office on our show over the years. They're friends and colleagues. So we're familiar with the torture cases. Speaking of attorneys and students who have worked on these cases, a few of them notably appear in more than one of your stories. Jane Raley is one. Did you know any of these attorneys personally?
I did. So I began researching this book about 4 years ago, and so in the early stages I had a chance to meet Jane Raley and other attorneys at the Center on Wrongful Convictions, the Exoneration Project, and other innocence projects. And, you know, these are, you know, the true heroes in the book. Jane is responsible for freeing, I think, about a dozen people, some from death row. And, you know, she was just a remarkable figure. I was very honored to have a chance to talk to her, like I said, in the early stages of the book when it was a series on Chicago Public Radio. She had a hand in two of the exonerations in the book, two of the exonerees that you'll meet, Christine and Jacques, and also a third exoneree who's in the book whose case, you know, did not fall on her deaf ears. Rather, she passed it on to someone who she knew could take on his case, and she didn't have the capacity at the time, but she, you know, really believed that he had a strong case of innocence, and so she passed on James, a third exoneree in the book. She passed his case on. So it takes so long for this work to happen, and, you know, it's sort of like winning the lottery for an innocent prisoner. One, you have to get someone's attention, and then secondly, you have to win. And we know that these innocence projects work for years on cases that sometimes don't win. And so it takes a lot of sheer serendipity, as innocence champion Rob Warden likes to say, to even get to the point where you're leaving prison and starting your life over again.
That's right, and I think you really portrayed that beautifully. I believe it was the third interview that starts with word on the phone, it's over. Mm-hmm. And it was quite moving to really consider the hundreds of letters that each of these individuals sends out routinely to different legal organizations trying to seek help. So when
Absolutely.
Their letters are answered, and when it actually, as you say, does go on for years and years, the serendipity factor is huge. We just have a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask, how did you pick the four exonerees that were portrayed in your book?
So I wanted to have a focus on Cook County for the reasons I stated earlier, you know, it being the wrongful conviction capital of the U.S. with the highest amount of exonerations. It's also the false confession capital, as we learned from 60 Minutes several years ago. And so I thought that I would want to focus in Cook County. So when this was originally a series for Chicago Public Media, it had three men who are still in the book, Antoine, James, and Jacques, and they were all convicted wrongly in Cook County. But when it came time to rethinking the format of the book for reformatting the series for a book, I really wanted to add a woman to the fray. You know, women are wrongly convicted for different reasons than men. Oftentimes they're accused of killing their own child or a loved one under their care, women being primary caregivers. And often in their cases, there was no crime that actually occurred. It was an accident or just a false accusation that led to their wrongful conviction. They experienced sexism at every step of the way. And I really wanted to portray that by adding a woman's case to the book. At the time that I was doing so, there wasn't a woman in Cook County. There are exonerees in Cook County who are female, of course, but there wasn't one who was in a good place to participate in this kind of project. And so I went outside to Indiana and met Christine Bunch, who is now in the book. And it was great because, you know, in Indiana, it's one of the states that does not provide any level of compensation or clear your record if you're an exoneree. And so Christine sort of lives under this veil of suspicion in her home state. She did move to Chicago for a while, as we see in the book, which kind of renews the Chicago focus. So it was also important to me to represent some racial diversity in the four people that I selected. So on the one hand, you have Christine, a white woman who didn't even have so much as a parking ticket to her name. And then you also have Antoine, who is a black man and was already in the system and was, from what it sounds like, wrongly in the system. You know, he didn't actually have a real criminal record, but things were planted on him, and he was known to police in the neighborhood and somewhat targeted. And that followed him after his wrongful conviction and exoneration, where, you know, he still felt that he was in the state's back pocket. So I thought that those racial disparities were really important to represent in whom I picked to be in the book.
Allison, have the individuals in the book read it? And if so, what has their feedback been to you?
So I know Christine has read her section because I am still meeting with her regularly. And, you know, she gave me her full approval, of course. And, you know, we met over the course, she and I did, over the course of a year and a half, almost every week, really just trying to get her story right. You know, unlike the men in the book, she was accused of killing her own son. The men did not know the victim in the case that they were, you know, wrongly accused of. And so it, to me, that presented so much more sensitivity and, you know, the need to make sure that she was comfortable with what was put out there. And as for the men, I think they have. I gave them all a signed hard copy at our launch event last week, and I read a couple of passages out loud, and, you know, many of them were crying as I was reading to the audience. And so I know that this is a really important project to them as well. They're immensely proud of it, and I'm just lucky that they trusted me and bestowed their stories for me to tell.
Well, this book, I should warn listeners, is not one that you can read without shedding many tears. But it's not maudlin. I love the factual quality, you know, as we mentioned before, the mundane issues that most people probably don't even consider that really make up the complexities of these people's lives. You're speaking in New York City at Blue Stockings Bookstore this week, Allison. How can listeners find out more about your appearances and more about the book?
Of course. So they can go to haymarketbooks.org and look up my book, Exoneree Diaries, there. There's a speaking tour listed, some extra videos of the exonerees and things like that. I'll be doing two events in New York City this week, one Tuesday night at Blue Stockings and one Friday at ThoughtWorks, which is a middle-of-the-day lunch presentation that people are also welcome to attend.
Allison Flowers, congratulations on what is really a tour de force, Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. It has been our special honor to talk to you today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.